So I, one of the talks about something that I've been, thought would be interesting to find out, and quite recently, in fact. So this is sort of not an expert's talk, and it's more of an outside interview. So that's my title. But just a kind of a general background. So, you know, Leonardo was a very famous artist and scientist, and he was very preoccupied with what we now call symmetry. And in this famous drawing of the Vesuvius Man, he used the symmetries of sort of the ideal human male form to solve the problem, or try to solve the problem of squaring the circle, which was a classic problem for mathematicians in antiquity. And the solution that he got using the golden ratio that he used quite often in his artwork to that he believed was relevant to the human form, the solution that he got was accurate within 99%. But eventually he gave up on that problem because, well, he couldn't solve it. In fact, it was shown about 300 years later that there was no solution to the problem of squaring the circle. So if you don't know what that is, the problem is that you have a circle, and you have a compass, and you have a straight edge, and you want to find a square, construct a square using the straight edge and the compass that has exactly the same area as the circle. And it was quite a fashion for mathematicians of his time, and had no solution. So I think it's sort of just an example of, let's say, the dangers of following passion too closely. Sometimes you can work on ridiculous problems that don't actually exist. But anyhow, he was also very interested in turbulent flows, and he used the tools that he had, which was his artwork. Here's a picture of how he saw turbulence. Here you have a flow coming in over here, and here you have the resulting generation of eddies and vorticity at many different scales. And so he actually realized that turbulence was a multi-scale phenomenon where you have sort of swirls within side swirls within side swirls. And in fact, if you go through the literature, you find that this is a problem that has preoccupied people, great men of science from Leonardo on to now. Finally called turbulence the last great unsolved problem in classical physics. And here are some drawings of Leonardo contemplating, I guess, the problem of turbulence. And then there's this, also this, of course, this famous quote about, that's been attributed to various people, including Heisenberg, that when he dies and goes to heaven, he will ask God for the explanation of quantum electrodynamics and turbulence, and he's optimistic about getting an answer to the first one. Okay, so in fact, if you look sort of out to the universe, to the data that comes from telescopes, you see all sorts of examples of extremely intermittent turbulent processes. So here's a picture of the remnant of a supernova that exploded about 50,000 years ago. And so what you have is, on the one hand, you have, if you look out, you have on the one hand things which look calm, everything seems in equilibrium, nothing seems to be changing too much. In fact, if things were not relatively quiet, then the Earth would not exist, and we would everything would just be all stirred up if we were, for instance, living in one of these things. But if you look over all of space, what you find are these isolated but still events happening, and you get these kinds of, again, turbulent structures at the scale of a galaxy here. But in fact, if you look even at larger scales, this is actually a very controversial subject. So if you look at the large-scale structure of luminous matter, so there's new results coming in from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which are at a much larger scale than what one was able to do before. So this is a contrast between the new results And the old results, what you see are structures of galaxies, of bubbles, of sheets, that appear to extend really to very large scales on the order of 100 megaparsecs, whereas the entire universe is around about 1,000 megaparsecs. And this is really quite different than the standard cosmological picture of a homogeneous universe would suggest, and in fact may lead really to very different theories of cosmology if you have large scale structure at hundreds of megaparsecs. So that's something I'll be talking about again later. So in fact, if you can look at much smaller scales, you don't have to go to, obviously I showed you the pipe flow that Leonardo was drawing, but you can look at all sorts of different scales and you see examples of turbulent flows in plasmas and liquids. So, and you know what these are because you sort of have seen these images before and someone had told you that this is the red spot of Jupiter and this is flux loops on the sun, and these are colliding galaxies. And this is a color-enhanced picture of the actual turbulent wave behind a plane. But the idea is that all of these different systems, if you look, so you don't look over the whole size of the system, but you look at small scales, they have very similar statistical properties, which are independent of the specific system that you're looking at and reflect sort of general physical principles that occur at all these different scales. Now, of course, when you're talking about the universe, you have to think about the entire history of it. And I would say it's still a rather controversial, but well accepted, I mean, controversial to me, but say well accepted in the community picture of what has been going on over the history of the universe. And you have the initial period of inflation, and then as the temperature cools down because of expansion, you have a bunch of transitions, and eventually you get to what's called the decoupling transition, which is something that I'll talk about quite a bit now, where the temperature of the universe cooled down sufficiently so that matter could decouple from radiation. Basically, the radiation, the photons are not of sufficient energy to re-ionize hydrogen when the electrons and protons condense to form hydrogen. Now, all of these processes are strongly nonlinear processes, and one would sort of expect there to be a turbulent phenomena associated with all of them, naively. And of course, you can ask, and many people have asked this question, and Lee in particular has asked this question, what are the fundamental mechanisms involved? How do we get to a state that has not so much structure, like the light that we see here, the red spot of Jupiter? If you think that what you do is you start from the Big Bang, so you have this kind of, let's say it's an explosion. Why did this explosion lead to these complex structures in space and time rather than just a random fragmented gas, which is what explosions usually do, or collapsing into some relatively simple object? And this is called usually the fine-tuning problem of the initial condition. And there have been some, let's say, solutions proposed for this fine-tuning problem, one of which is Lee Smolin's theory of Darwinian selection of universes. Another possibility, which I don't know how much attention it has gotten, is that, in fact, if one thinks of the laws of physics as we know them now to be, that these laws, in some sense, are changing over time, then maybe there is some other formulation of these laws where things are fixed. But as we know them now, they're changing over time. And this could, as a dynamical process, be a process that self-organizes. But what I wanted to say about that is I'm not going to talk about that fundamental issue. I'm going to talk at, let's say, a more pedestrian level of looking at what we see on Earth, what we see in the recent universe, our understanding of turbulence in these systems. What does that tell us, for instance, what does that lead us to think about or explore or measure for the CMB radiation, for the distribution of luminous matter in the universe? So I'm really going to start at the decoupling transition in what I discuss. So I have to say a little bit about turbulence theory. So the theory of fluid turbulence, well, the theory of fluids is expressed in the Navier-Stokes equation. So here's one of the equations, which expresses actually conservation of momentum. And u is the velocity of the fluid at some point in space and time. So everything is non-relativistic. You have the partial derivative, then you have the advective term, or what's called the inertial term, because in fact what you're doing is calculating the time derivative of a fluid particle moving along with it. So that's why you have this term. And then you have the forces on the system. One of them is due to the pressure. You have a viscous term, and you might have some external forces like gravity. And this equation, set of equations, is because of the non-linearity, that's because basically of the diffusive term, is an incredibly difficult problem to solve using analysis, and also very difficult to solve using numerical methods. And the reason is, going back to the picture that Leonardo drew that I showed you before, is that you get these swirls inside of swirls, or vorticity with many at many different scales. And anytime you have a multi-scale phenomenon like that, you have a very difficult problem. The important thing to know about fluids, though, is the Reynolds number. So the Reynolds number is the ratio of the inertial forces to the viscous forces. And if you rescale your units of velocity, time, and length, you can write this. You get a dimensionless a number out, which is called the Reynolds number, and which just expresses this ratio of forces, or equivalently, the diffusion time scale divided by the advection time scale. So it tells you how slow is diffusion compared to advection. And this is a dimensionless number. So this is the average velocity of the flow. This is the characteristic length of the flow. So if you've got flow in a pipe, it would just be the width of the pipe. And this is the viscous coefficient, nu. And it turns out that you can relate flows in many different types of systems. You can look at air flowing, you can look at water flowing, you can look at honey flowing, you can look at all bunch of different scales. And the patterns that you will see will be the same in these different systems as long as they have the same Reynolds number. So if the Reynolds number is very small, so the inertial forces are not that much bigger than the viscous forces, then you get laminar flow. So laminar flow is what you feel when you're flying on an airplane and the personnel tell you that it's okay to get up and walk around. So everything is smooth. The air flowing around you is smooth and uniform in space and time. But if you increase the Reynolds number, so the inertial forces become much bigger than the viscous forces, you have a transition to this turbulent regime where everything gets stirred up. And this you can feel in an airplane when they tell you to sit down and everything starts shaking. Now, you'll notice when you're flying on this airplane that that this dissipation field, when the airplane is shaking, is intermittent in space. So it's not going to be the same as you fly across the Atlantic. Everything will be perfectly smooth, and then suddenly, boom, you'll hit the intermittency, you'll hit turbulence, they call it. And then you have to sit down, and then after 15 minutes or so, it's over with.
It's not like everything in a fixed Reynolds number is behaving the same. On average, if you average over time, it is. But if you took a snapshot of the system and looked in space, it would be very spatially intermittent, very inhomogeneous. And that's a very important point to realize about turbulent systems. So when I was preparing this talk, I typed into Google turbulence and universe, and the first hit that came up was my talk. And I was thinking, gosh, there's some problem with Google, or there's some problem with physics, or there's some problem with me. Which one it is. And in fact, if you have a look at this, what you'll see is most of the people who are talking about turbulence in the universe are not cosmologists at all. They're coming at it from different fields, like cosmic physics, or complex systems, or statistical physics, like me. And the reason is that they see things in the data that look a lot like what they see in ordinary systems, which can't possibly have, you know, dark energy, dark matter, and all this sort of thing. Okay, so one fellow, for instance, has proposed that you could actually study cosmology, the Big Bang, by what happens in fusion reactors, and published a paper about that. Because what he said was that the distribution of voids and galaxies looks remarkably like what they see in their experiments on plasmas. Now, if you go and talk to most cosmologists about that, they'll just say it's ridiculous. This fellow, the plasma physicist, thinks it all comes from turbulence in the early universe, and by that he means the Big Bang turbulence. And in fact, it's quite easy to rule that kind of a picture out, as pointed out by Eisenstein, because those fluctuations will get smoothed out. And what he says is that, now referring to the CMB picture, the CMB data coming from the WMAP, that the smoothness, that there's no way to reconcile a picture of turbulence without throwing out all the WMAP data. So I want you to remember that quote. I'm going to show you something which is in direct contradiction to that. Okay? So a couple years ago, let me just explain a little bit about what happened again in the decoupling transition. So if you go back to a redshift of 1,000, so the universe was roughly 1,000 times smaller than it is now, the temperature was around 3,000 degrees Kelvin. And so you've got lots of photons with a black body spectrum at 3,000 degrees Kelvin, and you have electrons and protons. And these electrons and protons may get close to each other, and then they can form hydrogen. And if the surrounding photons are not hot enough, it's not efficient to reionize them, and so it just condenses. Now, when you look, when it condenses, this hydrogen then is not coupled to the photons anymore the way that it was when you had electrons and protons. So the electrons and protons are constantly scattering off the photons, but when they collapse into hydrogen, the radiation can just escape. So when people look at this background radiation, what they're seeing is mostly the radiation at last scattering, the last time that photon saw an electron or a photon. And what you find when you look at this CMB radiation is that so what you're measuring is sort of the temperature of different parts. When you look at that radiation, it's a black body spectrum, and you're measuring the temperature of different parts of the universe at the time of scattering. And about, this was discovered in the 60s by Penzias and Wilson, that you got this almost uniform background radiation. And since then, over the 70s and over the 80s, the uniformity of that radiation was made more and more precise. And around 1980 or so, it was realized that the temperature fluctuations, delta T over T, coming from these photons at last scattering, was around 10 to the minus 3. And now it's been realized that this delta T over T is actually smaller. It's now 10 to the minus 5. So these are limits that are replaced by detection. And actually, when there was actually a lot of discussion of the universe being in a turbulent state up until this point in the 80s when this bound was placed upon the temperature variation by, you know, for instance, a lot of Russian physicists. But once that bound was placed, this whole notion of turbulence was completely abandoned because it was felt that that indicated that the universe was actually, or at least the, was in equilibrium at the decoupling transition, because how else would you get such small temperature fluctuations? So the picture that what people have is that at this decoupling transition, everywhere is exactly the same temperature, everything condenses more or less at the same time, and nothing is left behind, okay? Now, that's the picture. On the other hand, what you observe now, if you look at luminous matter, that's the matter that you can actually see, so I'm not talking about dark matter at all, is, as I showed you earlier, you have galaxies, you've got clusters of galaxies, you've got clusters of galaxies, and if you try to measure the correlation length in an unbiased way of this luminous matter, then you get actually very large correlation lengths from available surveys. Could be perhaps 300 megaparsecs. There's a paper by Hogg et al. Now suggesting it's only 75 for the latest Sloan Digital Sky Survey. But it's still actually, whatever, if it's around there, it's still actually rather big correlation length. And it seems very difficult to try to explain that starting from an almost in equilibrium state with almost perfect. Basically, you can relate this temperature fluctuation is approximately equal to density fluctuations as well. So it seems very difficult to sort of relate the strongly inhomogeneous matter distribution, at least luminous matter distribution, to what was going on at the decoupling transition. And what we proposed was that these two things are actually not inconsistent at all. They can actually be perfectly consistent if you think of the universe, instead of being in equilibrium, as being in a very high Reynolds number state. And actually what started this was a paper that appeared, that was actually discussed in The Economist and so on, by Lanzetta et al., where they, using dust as a proxy for luminosity, suggested that there was actually frenzied star formation already half a billion years after the Big Bang. So you go back to redshift 10, and you've got actually a higher rate of star and galaxy formation than you have now. And from what I've been told, what's even more convincing of this accelerated galaxy formation at early times is the optical depth coming from the WMAP data. But that's actually a rather technical point that I don't want to go into now. But the question that the astrophysicists and cosmologists are very interested in is, what was the rate of galaxy formation going backward in time? Was it higher or lower than it is now? When did it really get going? Now, if you use, for instance, these cold dark matter models, what you have is very small density fluctuations at the beginning. These, eventually, you get small clumps, and then using this cold dark matter, you can get galaxies to form late in time, although it's difficult to get galaxies to form early in time using such models. Furthermore, as far as I can tell, it isn't possible using such models to get large-scale correlations in the system up to 300 megaparsecs. Now, I want to, again, sort of emphasize the idea that a very high Reynolds number system can actually look like an equilibrium system. So imagine that you're back in this airplane, and everything seems smooth. And so you could happen to be actually extremely lucky, and you can fly from one place to another and never hit turbulence. That doesn't mean that the atmosphere is in equilibrium. Some other time when you fly, you might find that you hit a very strong turbulence, and the plane is shaking, and there's a lot of dissipation going on. So the picture that you have at very high Reynolds number is that you have the C, which looks like an equilibrium system. There's no dissipation of flows or lambda. And then you can have, let's say, this very sort of tenuous structure, let's say like a spider web, that is not a space-filling structure, where you've got very high dissipation and the system is hot. And if that is what was going on at the decoupling transition, then these hot regions of matter would not condense when the rest of space did condense. And they would remain hot, and they would just go right through the decoupling transition. And these would be the sources for the formation of galaxies. So the point is that the scale of these things can be very small in most directions. I draw this as being sort of a connected thing, but that's probably a rather misleading thing. And so if they're not space filling, when you look at the full radiation that comes from this, you'll only see very small signatures of that. And you'll have actually very small absolute temperature fluctuations, again, because those regions are extremely tenuous. But they are nevertheless already hot and can already provide the seeds for the formation of galaxies. So, of course, I don't want to give you the wrong idea that we really understand very well what intermittency is or how to describe it.
Can you explain why the temperature fluctuation would be small again? Is it because there's not a lot of them, or they're long and thin?
No. Well, if you look at the dissipation structure in an ordinary turbulence, it isn't space filling. It tends to be extremely anisotropic. If you throw magnetic fields in there, you will get even more anisotropy in the system. So what happens in the ordinary fluid is you've got these sort of vorticity strings. They're like singularities. So around there, you've got the fluid swirling extremely fast, and further away, it's flowing normally. Okay, so very close to this thing, you've got very, very high dissipation. Now, I'm not saying that that's the structure you should be thinking of, because there are lots of other things going on. But the point is that if you have these dissipating objects are not space-filling, they have, let's say, some fractal dimension, let's say it's 1. So it's just some extremely tenuous thing. Then when you look at the radiation that comes from all of that, it's going to have a very small contribution, because the net density of those structures is 0 in the limit of a very large system. That's what I'm saying. So you can have very sparse regions of very intense dissipation that are very out of equilibrium. And when you look at this delta T, when you measure in a pixel, you know, when they do the math, right, you're getting radiation from some part of space, and so you're adding up the contributions from different parts of space. So it's like an integration, really.
Okay.
Is that clear? Okay. But that doesn't mean that there will be no signature in the temperature field of these things, and I'll get to that later. Actually, I think I'll just skip that. So what we proposed was just what I have already said, that in their back, it's almost like the picture before, except that you have the C, which is almost filling all of space, which is in equilibrium, and then the plasma condenses into hydrogen, and this radiation gets released. However, through some process which I don't completely understand, we propose that you still are left behind with these bursts that were hot before the transition, and therefore there was no decoupling that went on there. They just completely unaffected by this process. And these would be then the seeds, not the small Gaussian fluctuations for the galaxy formation. So, in fact, there has been some empirical data now supporting this view. And this was first done by people who study turbulence, so Vershadsky and Srinivasan, who have spent years studying ordinary turbulent systems. And one, what you do when you study ordinary turbulent systems, the most popular thing is to look at these structure functions. So you look at velocity differences along some direction. So these are strictly vectors, of course, but let's say longitudinal velocity differences. So you look at the component of velocity along the vector r, okay? And you look at moments of that. And what you find is that there's scaling of these moments with r to an exponent that depends on p. And if you have a Gaussian theory or a homomorphic theory, then zeta p is a linear function of p. So if you plot zeta p versus p, if you look at homomorphic theory, which is the dimensional analysis theory for fluid turbulence, you get a straight line here. So you measure these discrete moments, and you should get your points falling on a straight line. But in fact, when you go and do the measurement, you get actually the third moment, which by symmetry has got to be on this line, falls there, but you get this other curve, so it falls below the Homomorphic theory. And this is called intermittency corrections, and has been studied for about 20 years at least in turbulence experiments and verified in many different experimental situations. And in fact, there's a, let's say, phenomenological form called the Shi-Levesque scaling form, which I won't write down for you, which fits this curve extremely well, and is associated with what's called scale covariance, something I'll talk a little bit about later. So, if instead of measuring the velocity differences, you can also measure how the energy, average energy dissipation in a region of size r scales with r. And you can relate, and that exponent is called mu, which is the one that's discussed here. And you can actually, these exponents, zeta and mu, are related by linear relation to each other. So what Vershadsky did, since he had measured these sorts of things in turbulent systems, so basically you look at moments of some quantity in the field, and you look at space increments of the moments, okay? So it's quite natural to go and look at the CFD data. So we first looked at the COBE data, and if you want to characterize the energy dissipation in a volume V, divided by the volume, so that's the energy density, and that should have anomalous scaling associated with the anomalous scaling of these velocity fluctuations. But the CMB data is in the form of pixels, so instead of doing an integral over the volume, you just look at the gradients integrated over a line and then average that over different directions. And you get, actually, if you plot then the corresponding, so S denotes the number of pixels, and if you look at the corresponding moments of that surrogate for dissipation in the CMB, you actually get quite good scaling on a log-log plot, and by fitting these lines, you can come up with exponents. And what you see immediately is that these exponents are not linear in P, which is what a Gaussian theory, strictly Gaussian theory, at least in the sense of statistical physics and ordinary turbulence, a Gaussian theory would say that these moments have got to be a linear function of P. And what you see is that, first of all, that they're not linear if you believe this data analysis, which, of course, most of the people in the CMB community at first did not believe, because it wasn't done by a person who works in the field. But I'll get again to that later. And this is a comparison with this Shi-Levesque form for turbulent energy dissipation that has been around for about 10 years in turbulence. So this is just just taking the CMB data, the pixelized CMB data, and computing various moments of the temperature fluctuation. Still, and you can do a similar analysis instead of computing this kind of grad T by just looking at temperature differences, which is probably the simplest thing to do, and you get similar behavior.
I mean, if I forgot about the bottom point, it looks kind of linear to me. I mean, how non-linear is that really? Right? I mean, there are error bars in those things, so I could plausibly.
I'm not done with the story yet. Why don't you let me do two more data slides, okay? And then we can discuss it again.
Okay.
So this was repeated for the WMAP data using two different cutoffs. That's a kind of a technicality in the temperature fluctuation. Now they're actually comparing with not the sheet Leavitt form for ordinary fluid turbulence, but the kind of corresponding sheet Leavitt form for alkane wave turbulence. But that's a kind of obscurity which I really don't want to go into. And again, they actually got a very good fit with this form for the dissipation field. Now, what I didn't show here, but you can go and look in their paper, they actually looked at these temperature differences, and they look up to higher moment. They go up to T equal 12 or something. I don't have that here in this talk, although I have it on my PDF file, so I can come to that later if you want to have your paper on my computer. You don't actually see the strong deviations until you get to around P equals 6 in this variable here, the temperature difference. So you don't see the strong deviations from the linear behavior. On the other hand, this was actually now been tested by professional people in the field who are, for instance, heavily involved in the plant data. This didn't come out very well. They compare they actually measure these zeta p's rather than the mu's. And not only did they look at the original data, but they looked at various types of surrogates for it. For instance, they took the lambda CMB power spectrum for the amplitudes of the angular for the amplitudes of the CLs, they're called the things that you mentioned in the power spectrum, and they assumed that these were uncorrelated, which is the normal Gaussian approximation in this field, although I find that strange to call that Gaussian. In these different cases, they got sort of different non-linear curves, and they found that, in fact, the lambda CMD power spectrum with random phases and the Gaussian approximation actually also gives you this kind of non-linear scaling form. So they are actually saying, I think, that you can just get this from the power spectrum. So I don't really know what to make of that. If you look in the turbulence lens literature, there's quite a lot of work that suggests that in order to get these intermittency corrections, you have to take more than two-point correlation function into account. So I don't know. There could be some weaknesses with the data. Okay. I'm going to come back to that story with the CMB a little bit later, one more time. But now I want to talk about, well, let's say, a way of thinking about turbulence or a toy model for turbulence. And this was it's called the forest fire model, and it's proposed by Chen and Tang. And it's a way to think about the pattern of dissipation in space and time of a turbulent system rather than a system that's got inertia and viscosity and all those sorts of things. So let me just explain the model. Let's say you have a three-dimensional model. This is a two-dimensional model. But let's say you have a three-dimensional model. And at each site, you can either have an empty side that would be black here, or you could have a tree that would be green, or you could have a tree on fire and that would be yellow. And you start a system with some trees, some empty sites, and some fires, and you let the system evolve according to the dynamics, which I'll explain in a minute, but you never add any more fires to it. So you just start it in some state. And the rules are as follows. So the burning site is supposed to be represent dissipation and turbulence. So the rule is that if you have a tree that's on fire, at the next time step, it burns, it sets the neighboring trees to it on the lattice on fire, if there are any, and burns itself down, leaving an empty site. That's the first rule. And the second rule is, well, if that's all you ever had, then the fire would eventually burn out, and you'll be left with a system just of trees and empty sites. So you need some way to pump energy in. And the way that you do that is that you grow trees randomly on empty sites with some small probability p. And then you just go back to the first step. And that's all you do. You just go through this cycle over and over again. It's a very simple model. And what you find is that if you're studying an L by L system, so it has a certain size. Now, if P is too small for that size, eventually you're not growing trees fast enough and the fire just burns out. But if P is large enough for that size, you can get into a steady state where you always have fires. They persist infinitely long, even though you never added another one. And when you look at that, so you have this range of scales where the correlation length for the fires is much less than the system size, so the fires don't go out. And if you look at scales L, they're smaller than this correlation length and bigger than 1, you can see correlations in the pattern of fires. And so the question is, what kind of geometry does the dissipation field in this very simple system have? So one view is that it would just be uniform. That would be like Kumagawa theory in turbulence.
Dissipation field is just the trees on fire.
Mm-hmm. It's just the trees on fire. So what's the geometry of that structure? Statistically speaking, right? I'm not talking about precise geometry at any one point in time. I'm talking about some average properties of the system at different scales. So what's the right geometry? So one idea would be that dissipation would just be uniform in space. So another idea is that the dissipation would be fractal in space. And what that means is that what fractal means is as follows. If you take, what you can do is you can find a site that's on fire, and you can go around that site constructing, if you're in 3D, spheres of bigger and bigger and bigger size. And then you can calculate the number of fires in a sphere of size L, or a box of size L, that contained at least one fire. And if it was fractal, it would go with some fractal dimension TF. And if it was uniform, if the dissipation was uniform, this TF would just be equal to 3 in 3 dimensions, or 2 in 2 dimensions. And so if you wanted to calculate the fractal dimension of this, well, one way to do that is just to compute the logarithmic derivative. So you would get then the d log n d log l is just equal to df. And that would give you the fractal dimension. So, and in particular, if you plot log n versus log l, you should just get a linear behavior, right? You take the logs of both sides for a simple fractal. But what you actually find from the numerical simulations is that you get a quadratic behavior. So if you compute the log of the number of fires in a box of size L versus L, you get these quadratic functions. And these different curves are for different values of P and for different system sizes L. And all of these curves can be described with this formula, which is just a quadratic function
evolving log L for the square. So if you, you can still, let's say, compute a fractal dimension for this kind of an object. So this object is not fractal, but it's not uniform either. It's not scale invariant. It's something that's called scale covariant. It's associated with a symmetry, the symmetry of scale covariance, which I'll talk about in a minute. Next, so if you just compute the way that you normally would a fractal dimension by taking d log n d log l, you just get this expression, and what you, this is then for the different sets of curves. What you find is a linear increasing dimension up to the point where the length scale that you're observing is equal to your correlation length, and then you see that the dissipation field is uniform. Now, if you had just a fractal with some kind of ordinary crossover, then you would see some fractal dimension for small scales, and then it would sort of cross over like that. And there's no indication that that's actually what's going on. And you can say, well, it seems kind of like an arbitrary thing to do. But let me explain what the point here is. So if you look at small scales, what you see are point-like objects with dimension near zero. If you look at intermediate scales compared to the correlation length, you'll see perhaps string-like objects with a dimension of one. If you look at larger scales, you'll see sheets. And if you look at eventually large enough scales, you'll see a homogeneous structure. So the system is not a scale invariant system. It actually, this form here is actually a scale covariant system. So the point is that the dissipation field is invariant under a length transformation that leaves the smallest scale unchanged. So the smallest scale before was L0, which is the unit, the lattice unit length. So you could, the transformation of a scale covariant system is you rescale lengths by a factor that depends on their length. Yeah? Whereas in a normal scale invariant system, you rescale all lengths by the same factor. So you also shift your small length scale. So in a scale the relation between scale covariance and scale invariance is quite similar in principle to the relationship between Galilean invariance and Lorentz invariance. In Galilean invariance, you shift all velocities. And in Lorentz invariance, you shift velocities, but you keep one velocity fixed, which is the speed of light. And the indication from these numerical simulations is that you have scale covariance in dissipation of a nonlinear system. And in fact, this is kind of interesting, because Duvall and collaborators in France have been writing a lot about a theory for scale covariance and how we could explain the Chi-Levesque statistics for turbulence. So now we've got this dissipation field in this forest fire model, which amazingly has got this scale covariant form that's been described by Duvall to explain this intermittency corrections in turbulence, which also appears in the CMB. Maybe, okay? What about the distribution of luminous matter in the universe? So this sort of led, let's say, to an analysis of galaxy catalogs, a reanalysis of galaxy catalogs, where you can do the same thing. Now you're looking at gamma, which is not exactly this n, but it's n divided by a volume element, so it's like a density. So you look at how you have clusters of galaxies and clusters of galaxies and so on. And as you may know, Pietro Nero and collaborators have been claiming for many years that this correlation structure of luminous matter was fractal. And if you go back to the papers, what you find is that the early papers, which were looking at small scales of this object, were getting a dimension around 1.5. And as the scale of what they were able to measure had increased over time due to increases in the quality of the data, the dimension has actually increased over time as well. And this, it turns out that if you look at this
galaxy, look at this data from the catalogs, you actually get a very good fit with the scale covariant form, whereas you can see a slight difference between these two best fits. So the dashed line here would be the ordinary fractal form, and this solid line here is this scale covariant form. But this is from old data, and not from the new Sloan data. So we'll have to see how that works out. But one of the things that you get out of here, out of this analysis, which I didn't include, unfortunately, is an estimate of what the correlation length is for all of these things. And what we find, so the estimate of the correlation length is not obtained by fitting these curves. It's obtained in a different way. It's obtained by calculating, basically, d log n, d log l for the different curves and seeing when that extrapolates to 3. Okay, when do you get a fractal dimension of 3? And at what length scale does that happen? And then that's actually used, that parameter that is actually used here, so it's not a free fitting parameter. And you get consistent results for all of these data sets of around 300 megaparsecs.
Where is that
happen from? This is this is a different catalog of, this is the LEDA data. These are the data that's referred to in Pietranero and Silos Lagini's long review article where they claimed in RevNOP, where they show evidence for the fractal behavior. So it's exactly the same data that's shown in that paper, just reanalyzed. Okay, well, I hope I've sort of given you a feeling for, well, why the subject is so interesting, and maybe some ideas as well for some new ways of looking at these things, thinking about them as non-equilibrium systems. Thanks.
A lot of time for questions. Comments, remarks?
So, if there is turbulence, can one find out where it takes from or what's the reason for it?
Well, I mean, there are a number of, let's say, proposals for where it's from. I mean, one possibility is it's been suggested by Subramanian and Barrow that you have actually these tangled magnetic fields at the decoupling transition. And these can lead to density perturbations which are not compressional. And so you can get very small scale intermittent structures this way. Now, I should say that there are a lot of damping mechanisms that are going on at the decoupling transition. One of them is called silk damping, and there are other ones which which invoke some constraints on the smoothness of the field at different scales. However, if you look at the calculations for instance, for the silk damping, they're spherically symmetric. They don't take into account magnetic fields. They don't take into account some other nonlinearity. So I think that this is a very important question to figure out what is the source of it. I have my own idea at this point, but it's just a guess, really, which is that, I mean, from what I can tell, anyhow, the people who have looked at the physics of decoupling use a mean field calculation. There's no space in these calculations. What you have are the energy levels of hydrogen, and you have photons, and you have transition rates. Right, so you just get these rate equations. You can make them quantum mechanical. Okay, it doesn't matter. And you find out that 3 levels in hydrogen are important, and you can sort of forget about the rest of them. But these calculations don't involve what's happening in space. So what you actually have is some kind of a condensation process And associated normally with condensation processes in ordinary physical systems, you have domain growth. You could all, the only thing is that you have to just leave, when the whole thing is over and done with, you just have to leave some stuff behind that didn't condense. And there's a lot of nonlinearities that could be involved in that. They could have been there before the decoupling transition. In spite of the self-damping, this is what these people are arguing, that you can still, you can have small primordial fluctuations at very small scales, less than a self-damping due to these tangled magnetic fields. Or you can have some processes going on in the decoupling transition itself. I don't know.
So, but a generic leftover from a condensation would cause turbulence?
Well, the question is, the question is, was there hot stuff left over from the decoupling that didn't go through the transition? Well, that's something that I've been really interested in trying to sort out, really, how this could come about. And also, I mean, with the new missions that are going up, you know, the planet mission, for instance, I mean, I can say that one result of this kind of questioning have been sort of the realization that this is the kind of measurement that they're going to want to do with the new data, to measure these space moments of space increments, that you can test some things in the data that you weren't able to test otherwise. And you'll be able to answer the question of whether it really is behaving this way as well, not only just how could it be. So the short answer is I don't know, and actually I don't think anyone else really does either.
So at some point we're going to be talking about measure of non-gas energy.
Yeah.
So just maybe have a comment in the something that people in the field, I don't know much about this, but people in the field have been looking for is tests of the CNV data that would show that it could not come from a random Gaussian distribution.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing is that the way that Gaussianity is defined in the CNV community is, I don't understand it. I mean, the way that it is you take a power spectrum, and then you have your your amplitudes of the field of CL, right? I think you know this. And what you do is you assume that these things are like delta function correlated. So you get delta L prime, delta A, K prime. So the amplitudes are not correlated with each other. I don't quite know how to think. I mean, but to me, you can see something. First of all, you can see some things in Fourier space, which would you might not be able to detect things in Fourier space which are localized in real space very well. That's one thing. I think this is a kind of unusual definition of Gaussianity, and also. I suppose what it means is that you don't need to measure higher order moments of the temperature fluctuations in K-space. But, well, that's a huge subject. I mean, this guy Imperial has been working, for instance, what's his name? This Argentinian guy.
Actually, it's Portuguese.
Has been working on sort of tests of this non-Gaussianity, but I don't. I don't think that it's very clear, really, what the best types of measurements to make on the available data are, and in addition to that, ways of testing things, because you've got to do the subtraction. You have to do subtraction problems. It could be that all of the stuff that I talked about is just due to the galaxy, you know, or due to some secondary scattering, or whatever.
But I just have a simple question. What you showed could be interpreted as an observable of the CMB data that differs from what would have been expected were the CMB just randomly.
No, I mean, yeah. So, it doesn't have anything apparently, well, I have to say I'm not really clear on that. This work by, what Lazelski is claiming is if you take the power spectrum and you mix the amplitudes, you can start the field assuming that they're uncorrelated. Okay, so that's the only information that goes into your field with random phases. You still get out this curving behavior. Now, in order to match it up with what you see, you have to add something else to it. Okay, so I don't quite know what to make of that.
Yeah. What if it's dark matter would be turbulent?
I'm sorry?
What if dark matter today would be turbulent? What kind of properties would it have to have?
I'm not the person to ask about dark matter. I mean, I just,
well,
yeah.
We don't know, basically we know nothing about it, okay? So
well, we don't even know
that it's mass density, basically.
I'm sorry?
We know kind of it's mass density, and that's about it.
Yeah, I know that. That's what, I mean, now I'm going to be quite heretical. I'm not actually convinced that there is such a thing as dark matter. So that would affect the large-scale structure of luminous matter and of the sort of CMB radiation and things like that. I mean, there's certainly some in galaxies and so on from the that was shown before, but I have no actual opinion about that. I know that some people are working on turbulence in dark matter. I've seen a little bit of work on that, but I really don't know enough to say. What, do you have an opinion about it?
Yeah.
Last question.
In Bart's fire model, what plays the role of the Rayman bomb?
Yeah. Well, there is something similar. So the Reynolds number in fluid turbulence, you can show that you get scaling for this of this form which I raised between a small length and a big length. And these lengths depend on Reynolds number in different ways. So you have a range of scaling that depends on the Reynolds number. So you have a range of scales which you can relate to the Reynolds number. That's the point that I wanted to make. So if you just take that as a definition of the Reynolds number, what is the range of scales, which is not exactly correct, then you can say that the forest fire model has got a Reynolds number by comparing its range of scales. You can sort of infer a Reynolds number, if you know what I mean, by just measuring the range of scales that you have. That's basically going from your lattice unit to this correlation I've just given by that. Okay? But it's strictly not true. I mean, there isn't any inertia in the forest fire model, so there isn't any direct way of measuring that there. Now, that's actually a very interesting question. Not only in the forest fire model, but in some of these sand power models, can you define a dimensionless quantity which would behave in some ways like the Reynolds number and use that to compare with turbulent signals? So actually, I'm quite interested in that.
Okay, so let's thank Maya again. Thank you for seminar series, so perhaps Maya, if you now vote whether we should continue next semester.